Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Laura Lee. And adding to our ongoing series on filling in those missing chapters of our earliest and most ancient history, we welcome back Michael Cremo. He spent 8 years combing through old and new reports of odd artifacts of human origins to re-examine the story of human evolution. And he concludes that the anatomically modern human tree may branch back millions of years, not just a few hundred thousand, but millions of years. You can read all about it in his two books, co-authored with Richard Thompson, Hidden History of the Human Race and Forbidden Archaeology, both, of course, carried by the Radio Bookstore. Welcome back, Michael. Good to see you again.
Good to be here, Laura Lee.
You've been busy for these last several years looking and adding to this story. This is a fascinating story that we may not have evolved from apes. Is that what you're saying, really? Well, or that we just evolved back much, much earlier than we think.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When people think about human origins, they tend to look for some very simplistic explanation. Either, you know, God created everything instantaneously from nothing in the beginning, or they look for, you know, a very simple evolutionary account. You know, the chemicals were in the Earth's early ocean. They, you know, combined to form the first living thing, the
even
first
cell. Even
though
they can't recreate life in the laboratory.
Yeah, even though they can't do it, but they think something like that. And then they think that that first cell split and divided, and some of them got together to make multi-celled organisms, and then some of them went from the ocean onto the land and became animals, and finally they became human beings.
Griffins went out on the land, suddenly we have human beings.
Right. And then another idea that's become popular in recent years is extraterrestrial interventions. You know, say that, you know, at a certain point in that evolutionary development, you know, some extraterrestrials came and turned some ape men into human beings like us by manipulating their genes. Now, of course, that leaves open the question, where did those extraterrestrials come from? But in any case, people tend to prefer some very simple creation account, some very simple Darwinian evolutionary account, or some very simple extraterrestrial intervention story. But from what I can see, and this is something I want to talk about in my next book, Human Devolution, the real story is much more complex. It involves all three of those things, I would say. It does involve some overall designed and controlled by some kind of guiding intelligence in the universe. I think it does involve a kind of evolution, which I prefer to call devolution, because I think it involves going from the more complex to the simple rather than going from the simple to the more complex.
And just so that doesn't hang out there from left field, you are being inspired in that thought by the Vedic text, of which you have devoted another part of your life to studying, and that's the story given in the Vedic text?
Yes, there is something like that. As you say, my work is inspired by my 30 years of study of the ancient Sanskrit writings of India and my, you know, spiritual practice, which is also based on that. And it's sort of interesting. I think really, you know, before we even can ask the question, you know, where did human beings come from, we should first of all ask the question, well, what is, you know, a human being? Because we should really know what it is we're trying to explain. And depending upon how you define what a human being is, you're going to allow yourself certain types of explanations. For example, the idea today, you know, as we were mentioning, is that, you know, human beings are like us, are just combinations of ordinary matter. You know, the chemical elements that you see in, you know, in the periodic table of elements, you know, that every student
learns. It's tied up in some very complex molecules.
Yeah, iron, calcium. Yeah, it's some complex arrangement of these ordinary chemical elements, ordinary material elements. Now, if you define a human being like that, that sort of limits your explanations. It limits the kinds of explanations you can give to basically explaining how those chemical elements could combine themselves together. But I would say that it's not a very reasonable assumption to say that we're simply composed of ordinary matter.
We are that, but you're saying there's another layer to us?
I would say two other layers. I would say we've got ordinary matter that's part of us. Then there are two other elements, which I call mind and consciousness. And consciousness, I mean, we all experience it. It's what allows us to perceive and taste and feel. And then there's mind, and mind, for me, is a kind of software. It's something material, but it's beyond the elements that we know, like iron and calcium and oxygen and things like that. It's just another material element.
It seems to be a field state to it, is now some of the latest theories on this.
Yeah, a field that can act on objects made of ordinary matter in ways that we can't explain by our current laws of physics.
But it's a nice bridge between the matter, the world, and the world of consciousness.
And the world of consciousness, absolutely. It's if you were to look at a computer, the computer would be like our body made of matter. The software would be like the mind. And the user of the computer would be like the conscious self. And the software is the interface in between the conscious self and the computer, just like mind is the interface between consciousness and the gross physical body made of the ordinary chemical elements. So then once you've got that established, and I think there's some, we don't have to talk about ordinary matter because everyone already accepts that, but sometimes people will ask, well, where's the scientific evidence for this mind element, which I'm going to define as a subtle material energy field that can operate on ordinary matter in ways that we really can't explain. Now, just to give a very crude example so that people can kind of see what I'm talking about, air is a more subtle element than water. And you can't see air, but when the air moves over water, you can see the operation of the air. In other words, waves form. So that will give you the idea, well, there must be something that is agitating the water. I can't see it, but it's there. You can see it from its effects. So mind is something like that. Now, in my previous work, Forbidden Archaeology, I talked a lot about the knowledge filtering process, the knowledge filtering process that has suppressed evidence, physical evidence in the form of
that same knowledge filter. Is it what you're saying with looking at the scientific evidence in support of consciousness
and
this mind field?
Right. Because, there's so many human skeletal remains and so many human artifacts that I talked about in Forbidden Archaeology that aren't mentioned in the current textbooks because of this knowledge filter
right,
process.
Every time they see something that sits outside of their parameters, what's accepted, they discount it. You get a lot of discounted objects at the end of the day when you look at all of the evidence as you and Richard have done over that 8-year survey. An astounding number.
Oh yeah, huge
as
number.
As much that's kicked out of the picture as is in the picture.
Yeah, absolutely
which
right.
Which demonstrates it's not really anomalous after all. It's not the odd bit here and there. Mm-hmm. It's a substantial amount.
Yeah, and another important thing to consider, Laura Lee, is that those discoveries, those archaeological discoveries, putting the human race back millions and millions of years, these are discoveries that were made by professional scientists that were reported in scientific journals. They're not marginal discoveries. The people who made them aren't of questionable character at all. So the same is true of this evidence for a mind element that can operate on matter in unexplained ways. Every physics student will read about Pierre and Marie Curie. Everyone knows they were husband and wife, and they discovered the X-rays and radium, and they both got Nobel Prizes. Actually, Marie got 2 Nobel Prizes. And you read about this in every physics textbook. Every child learns to worship them, practically, especially Marie Curie, because she's one of the most prominent women.
And she was a martyr because that very discovery ended up killing her.
Yes, that's right. But what we don't read in the textbooks is that she and her husband were heavily involved in what's called psychical research, research into the paranormal, research into this mind element that I'm talking about. Actually, not just those two, the Curies, who both had Nobel Prizes, but a large group of prominent European scientists, many of them with Nobel Prizes, conducted 2 years of research with a medium named Eusebio Palladino in Paris early in the 20th century. And these experiments were carried out under carefully controlled scientific conditions. They were carried out in broad daylight in a psychological research institute in Paris and other such locations. And I'm not going to go through all the results here. I mean, we could spend the entire, you know, hour talking about that. But for example, on one occasion, the medium was being controlled by Marie Curie. In other words, the medium was being very carefully watched. Her hands and feet were being controlled to make sure she wasn't making any strange movements or anything like that. And in broad daylight, Pierre Curie said that in the middle of the room at the Psychological Research Institute in Paris, a large table was floating in the air with no one touching it. And he was measuring, you know, how far it's floating off the ground, how long it's staying in the air. And he testified this is absolutely true. His research notes are still there and at archives in Paris.
Were you able to go there and read them firsthand?
I want to go and read them. They came to my attention through a very, you know, obscure biography written by a French historian of science in the French language. It wasn't available in English. This is how I find out about these things, is by going to these obscure sources. I do want to go to those archives and do further research. But
you're saying they were they weren't slouches, they were Nobel Prize winners, they knew how to conduct a scientific experiment, and this
Absolutely.
Is what they testify to, and they wouldn't be putting their reputation on the line for a hoax that they hadn't checked out thoroughly. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So what does that mean? To me, it's positive evidence for this mind element, that there is a material energy that's connected with our body that can act on ordinary matter in ways that we really can't explain, you know, by those ordinary laws of physics.
To me, it's like, okay, we live with this, we have this from personal experience, we know that this works, we have to go to the scientist and have the good, healthy keeping seal of approval to let us believe what we already experience. Okay, fine.
Well, we don't have to do that. Not you and I.
Society at large. Okay, fine.
I don't need that. You don't need that. And there are a good many people who don't. But you know, it's sort of interesting. I could make a career of communicating about these things to people who already accept them. And I could do fine with that.
That's called singing to the choir. Yeah.
Yes. But somehow or other, I have this, I don't know, this
drive or something
to try. I like to try to communicate with people who already don't think the way that I do. And sometimes they have very fixed ideas. And I speak to many audiences, and one of them is the professional scientific audience. I speak at all kinds of gatherings. I speak at universities. I speak at corporations. I speak at mainstream scientific conferences. And I also speak to the alternative organizations and alternative groups and alternative media. But when you confront that mainstream scientific audience or audiences who, as you're suggesting, want that stamp of approval from that community, it helps to, because their assertion is this is not scientific. No rational scientist would have anything to do with this particular subject, and you have so many so-called skeptical societies.
The knowledge filter is very well
alive
today.
That are trying to suppress this and give people the impression that it's for people who accept them as authorities, anyways, that this is a field only for marginal people or crackpots.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's very interesting to bring out what I would call the hidden history of physics, the hidden history of science. And it's often quite shocking for these people to hear that.
It's also, you know, can you make a table lift up? It would also be interesting to know how are these various feats if and well they really happened, how were they accomplished? Are there any clues? Because it would be fabulous to, you know, Uri Geller, I guess, went through his scientific experiments conducted by SRI and others, and they still didn't believe them. The mainstream still doesn't believe that that took place. There's still question among everyone. Did that really happen?
Well, absolutely.
But today would be interesting. Get the psychic in, have her lift the table, and, you know, conduct some further tests.
But the thing is, it has been done, however.
Okay.
These things have been done.
All right, recently. And why is this on television?
Even if it were on television, probably, you know, someone would say,
it's video. You can fake anything.
Anything. Now, another thing to realize is these may be rare abilities.
Oh, it's David Copperfield.
These may be rare abilities. You know, just like, I mean, there are all kinds of things that people do that are rare, and they're not transferable, really. You know, some people, within the space of 10 years, they become billionaires. Or you have athletes that can do fantastic things. I think to some extent we all have these powers, but some people seem to have them to an extraordinary degree. And it may not be possible to get them to do it in a reproducible way. But there are many events that are like that. I mean,
there are so many hoaxes out there. You know,
absolutely.
Really good hoaxers. And so I think you get burned once, and then you start pulling in your belief system and going, okay, let me be very cautious here.
Sure.
Been burned once, don't want to get burned
absolutely.
Again.
Absolutely.
But there is a lot of that out there.
Yeah. Even in terms of just the straightest, most ordinary science, there's a tremendous amount of hoaxing going on, especially in the fields of biochemical and medical research. There have been very prominent scientists who have been caught, you know, fudging their data, or just in the field of archaeology. Last year, there was a case in Japan where some archaeologists had discovered a site about 500,000 years old, and a newspaper actually photographed a very prominent Japanese archaeologist the day before a press conference going and digging holes and planting, you know, stone tools in these holes. And he was exposed. And you know, he profusely apologized, of course. But, you know, you wonder.
What was his motive? Because he wanted to gain
he was already quite famous. But he said there was just so much pressure, you know, to find more and more things that he just took some stone tools from his collection and he, you know, put them in the ground, you know, just because, I don't know.
He needed that fix of getting the headlines in the newspaper.
But
another case of this you document very well in your books, and that's the Piltdown Man, now seen as a hoax.
Case. Well, that happened early in the 20th century, but what I think is interesting about this Japanese case is from the recent headlines.
Yeah.
You know, of course, the guy profusely apologized, but if he hadn't been caught, you know, we would
not know the difference.
We wouldn't have known the difference.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the main point is people think, well, it's only in research into the paranormal that you have to worry about, you know, these hoaxes and things. But the Piltdown case was from early in the 20th century, and there you had a researcher in England report that at a place called Piltdown, they had found a human-like skull and an ape-like jaw in an excavation that was about 1 million years old. And they said, finally, here it is, the missing link. And up to that time, they really hadn't come up with any good missing links. As I mentioned in Forbidden Archaeology, from the time that Darwin wrote a published Origin of Species in 1859, in the beginning of the 20th century, there were no really good missing links, you know, being found. As a matter of fact, what scientists were finding was evidence that humans like us went back millions and millions and millions of years. So they were looking for missing links, but they were just finding more and more evidence that humans of our type were going back very, very far in time. So this Piltdown Man appeared to be a very good missing link, because you had a piece of human skull and an ape-like jaw, and they put the two of them together, and they said, well, here it is. Here's the transition between the apes and the humans. It was actually in the textbooks for about 50 years until some scientists from the British Museum analyzed the discovery very closely and determined that the skull was genuine, but the jaw was a recent monkey jaw that had been filed and stained to make it look
somebody
like
went to a lot of trouble
a
to
fossil.
Fake it. Was
right.
This an innocent mistake? Well, it's interesting that the various efforts that have been taken to bolster up a particular point of view, thus turning science into propaganda, where science really, its mission is to look at the evidence in a neutral way and then see where that evidence leads, right? So,
well, that's
interesting that they
told.
Have to bolster. And you're saying even the scientists that go in and fudge the data, for whatever reason, they're bolstering a point of view to keep the current paradigm intact. You've also quoted those cases. Either the mere fact of tossing out the anomalous evidence, the evidence that demonstrates how far back anatomically modern humans go, that's just faking it to bolster the point of view that they want to persist.
Yeah, it's
I just don't like it when science has an agenda and it's not really truly exploring where the evidence leads. It's already made up its mind and it's coming in trying to bolster its position. That's my point.
Mm-hmm. And I think one reason why this happens is because it's there are various types of power in the world, military power, political power, economic power, and then there's also intellectual power, which is a very real power. It's a subtle power, but a very real one nevertheless. And those who possess it have the ability to set a direction for our whole society, or indeed our entire human civilization. And it seems they have set a very materialistic direction towards the whole thing. I think this is one reason why there's such resistance to this evidence for a mind element, this evidence for a consciousness element, and why there is so much focus on ordinary matter. Because the way civilization is set up now, we spend a tremendous amount of our energy developing the resources of matter, digging things up out of the ground and building them and constructing them and buying and selling them, and it's a whole operation. Even the internet and all the new media, they all depend upon some kind of physical superstructure. If we understood the reality of the mind element and the conscious element, then as a civilization, as a society, we might be putting more energy into developing those resources.
Of course.
Which would maybe take away from all the effort and energy that's now going into developing these material resources for the benefit of many people.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I mean, So I think that may be one of the underlying...
The society sits here and goes, we really can't afford to re-examine our priorities and what's on the other side of the equation, because it would force us to do things a bit differently. It wouldn't be business as usual. It wouldn't make sense.
Yes, I think that's right. Those are the types of reasons why... Because people often ask me, what possible reason would people have to direct people's attention away from certain types of evidence or try to suppress it? And I think there are some very, very real reasons.
Maybe subconscious reasons.
Subconscious reasons, yes. If we look at it, these scientists, the material scientists today have more or less become the priest of a new religion of matter, so to speak. And yeah, there's money, there's prestige, there's power involved. So I think for these reasons, there's a lot of resistance to, you know, any change in, you know, the basic paradigm. And this may be because of, you know, bad experiences that people have had in the past, you know, in history about, you know, from, you know, different religions who have strayed from their actual spiritual roots and gotten into different kinds of political manipulations on the material level. But really, religion in its essence should be a spiritual technology that helps us, you know, get in touch with, you know, the deeper levels of ourselves and in touch with the universe, really. But and as I said, maybe because of some bad experiences, you know, society in general has decided to turn away from that and just focus on developing the material resources rather than the spiritual resources.
We're talking with Michael Cremo. His books include Forbidden Archaeology. He'll be soon be out with Forbidden Archaeology 2, documenting some of the new cases he's found since then. Also, Hidden History of the Human Race, and you can look forward to Human Devolution. We continue our conversation just after this. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.
All interviews on The Laura Lee Show are available on audio cassette. For information, call 1-800-243-1438. The sweet secret of the herb stevia lies in a complex molecule called steviocide, a glycoside composed of glucose, saffron, and steviol, a complex molecule that gives this herb from Paraguay its extraordinary sweetness, 10 to 15 times sweeter than common table sugar. But here's the really extraordinary part. Stevia does not affect blood sugar metabolism. Some studies even report that stevia reduces plasma glucose levels in normal adults. Sweet, nutritious, natural, and good for you. Wisdom of the Ancients introduces Stevia Plus. Take these little packets with you everywhere, containing powdered stevia that equals 2 teaspoons of sugar and sweetness. Sprinkle on food and beverages alike. I use stevia daily. Add the liquid concentrate to lemon juice and water, and you have refreshing lemonade, and decarbonated water for a soda substitute. Stevia makes any herbal tea taste sweeter and better. Stevia is good for your skin, too, applied externally. Try it. It's versatile, good for you, and sweet without the calories.
Wisdom of the Ancient Stevia products are the highest quality available. Call 1-800-243-1438.
We all try to watch our diet to get a balance of nutrition, but that's not always possible. There's a gap between the nutrition from the average American diet and the optimum diet for the human system. The challenge is to take care of our own health while being able to enjoy comfort foods. That's why nutritionist and biochemist Udo Erasmus developed Missing Link. It bridges this gap with foods naturally high in essential nutrients, trace minerals, vitamins, and fiber. Call 1-800-243-1438. Missing Link is a powder that you sprinkle on your food, making your food taste better, and 3 tablespoons daily is all you need to achieve optimum nutrition. Call 1-800-243-1438. Each bag contains a 1-month supply and is only $19.95. Call
1-800-243-1438. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. Our guest is Michael Cremo. His books, by the way, are available at 800-243-1438. So, Michael, are you suggesting that in your picture that you've been putting together of the human story, by tracing it back and back and back, how did we evolve? You know, God didn't wave a wand and we appeared here. There was a progression of events, perhaps. So are you suggesting that rather than common ancestor. Apes go one way, we go another way on the branch of the tree for primate, that this fork in the road happened not a few hundred thousand years ago, as the evolutionary scientists are saying, but you're just pushing it back, that it happened millions of years ago? Or I'm just wondering, what is it that you're suggesting as a replacement theory and understanding for the development of the human being?
Mm-hmm. Well, I call it human devolution, and it gets back to this point I was talking about previously, that, you know, first of all, we have to decide what we are. And I think there's pretty good scientific evidence to show that we are a combination of ordinary matter. We are a combination of ordinary matter, mind, and consciousness, or spirit, if you want to call it that. And then we have to talk about, well, where did all these things come from? So I would say that our cosmos is divided into a realm predominated by ordinary matter, a realm predominated by the subtle mind element, and a realm beyond that predominated by pure consciousness, spirit, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that our original position is as pure conscious individuals in that realm of pure consciousness or pure spirit. When we depart from that, you know, attracted by the lower energies, our original spark of consciousness has to be given a vehicle that's suitable for operating at that level. Now, at each level of this cosmic hierarchy, there are beings who are adapted to life at those levels. For example, on the level of pure consciousness, that is the realm of the supreme conscious being, God, if you will, and others, including ourselves originally. And then there is a level below that, the level of mind, where there are beings who are a combination of consciousness and mind. These may be called gods and goddesses or angels, or there are different terms for them in different civilizations, but they are beings who are a combination of consciousness and mind. And it is through their reproductive processes that that conscious selves like us receive bodies for operating in the level of matter in which we now find ourselves. I've studied, as I mentioned, you know, these ancient Sanskrit writings, and they give a pretty detailed account, and I'm not going to go into it all here,
mm-hmm.
but there is a kind of, you know, evolution that goes on. And by evolution, I mean there's reproduction with modification. That means things reproduce, and in the course of that reproduction, things change. Now, in the material sense, the way that we've heard it up to now is that things go from the very simple to the more complex, and it's a purely material process. But there's some problems with that because, as you were mentioning, Laura Lee, and earlier in the show, they really haven't explained how you can get the chemical elements to combine to form the first living thing. And they haven't really explained either how you go from a simple thing to a more complex thing simply by random genetic mutations. We don't really see that happening. You know, you can't go to the back of your television set and pull out a wire and randomly stick it somewhere else and think you're going to get, you know, something that works better. Most probably, it's not going to work at all.
So your analogy is, how can some of these great changes happen between generations or between
without any intelligence behind it?
With just random plugging the wiring. Okay, but wasn't that what Darwin was trying to explain?
Right, that's what he was trying to explain. But he's
natural selection.
It's been about 100
years.
Oh,
when you come up with a happy accident, it will survive because it's better prepared. Mm-hmm. To its adapted new environment.
Yeah, so nobody's really explained exactly, you know, how that happens. They just say, well, it did happen. And they sort of wave the magic wand of the word evolution and say, well, it happened by evolution. But they can't tell you exactly step by step how you go from, you know, a creature with no eyes to a creature with a developed color vision.
Yeah, I also thought that there was such a strict protocol for the reproducing of a individual that if anything went wrong, the body would actually kick it out spontaneously and say, oops, back to the drawing board, let's try again. And so that you have such a slim margin for making any changes from one generation to the next because there's that inbuilt check and balance. to make sure that the copy is pretty much
right. Well, we can see there
an
are
an identical copy to the
yeah.
to the parent.
I mean, there are change. I mean, everybody knows that change is possible within limits. For example, you can breed dogs to become bigger. You can breed horses to become bigger or smaller.
Right, hybridization.
Can,
so there's a
can,
lot of margin.
You can
right.
do that, but the real thing is how do you get something new, something radically new and different?
Well, isn't that what you're suggesting when you go from no eye to eye?
Right. Now, that's what's not explained.
You're not just modifying eye. You're going from no eye to suddenly eye.
Right. And how do you get that without some kind of intelligence behind it? So, in this...
In fact, we've talked to, I think it was Richard Milton and others who say, look at the complexity of the eye as a case in point. How does that... How does accident, random series of accidents produce something so stunningly well-designed?
Absolutely. So... But in terms of this human devolution concept, there's intelligence behind it. There is some kind of reproduction with modification going on, but it's intelligently guided. And it's also involves the gradual, not just arranging matter in different ways, but taking consciousness and covering it first with mind and then with matter. So it's a couple of questions.
Are you suggesting that, you said earlier, if we trace everyone's just back, you would see not an ape, but a demigod, according
yes.
to this theory, according to the
a higher dimensional
path.
Being. Yeah.
A higher dimensional
being.
We can
call it an angel, we can call it a demigod, or
okay.
not just
given
one,
that, so then I have a couple more questions.
Angels. Right.
The question then would be, so in our state, are we normal for the process, or are you saying devolution implies we're kind of lower than what we were potentially expected to be, the expression that we are today?
Yeah, we are lower than our original state. In other words,
is this part of the plan because it's, you know, the Kali Yuga, or is this, but that's a much shorter cycle than the human being.
Well, it's our choice. It's our choice.
Oh, I see. It's one of the options.
Well, we all have attraction. I mean, everyone has different attractions. So you can see, I mean, maybe yourself, you say, well, I know I'm attracted to the right kinds of people or to the right kinds of beverages or to the right...
Oh, I see. You're saying we're just all addicted to all the wrong things.
Yes, we're addicted to the wrong
things. Much like food and drink, yeah.
Yes, you know, and it's an individual thing, but everyone has to live with their individual choices. For example, some people, I mean, we can see are attracted to things that we might consider to be extremely self-destructive, but that's their choice.
But aren't we choosing it as a collective whole here because we're all pretty much designed and made the same? We all pretty much have the same abilities and functions and this, that, and the other. You're suggesting that there's other human designs on other planets where the humans have decided, oh, let's operate a little higher to our potential?
Right.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, what about animals? Are you suggesting that the same is true for the species of canine? You mentioned dogs before. Why should humans be so special? Are we still placing us at the top of the heap here, above all the other animals, or do they have their...
Well, in one sense, yes.
Perfect
in another,
expressions
another
as well.
Sense, no.
Are there dolphins on these other planets that are, you know, thinking,
yeah.
speaking?
Yeah, there are.
Are there
there
dogs
there,
that are walking
are,
around creating technology
right,
on other planets? I mean, where's the potential begin and end for?
Now, this is, I mean, we have to
just imagining.
Cross the level here to belief and what I can, you know,
into speculation, sure. We're heavy and deep into speculation
right.
here.
But what I would say is this. And this is, again, it's based on, you know, my, you know, personal path that I've taken and, you know, what I know from different
Trust
sources.
Trust me, Michael, we're not
like
taking
that.
This as gospel. But, we're taking this as your personal
opinion.
What I would say is that
each conscious self is actually the same, has the same abilities, but they're in different vehicles. Now, if you got on a bicycle, you could ride at a certain speed. But then if you got in a Ferrari and started tooling around, you could go much faster.
Or give me the turbojet and see how
right.
fast I go then. So
right.
you're suggesting
right.
we're in the Ferrari, the other human beings that are expressing much better on planet XYZ over there are driving the turbojets, and the dogs are in the bicycles.
They're limited. They're limited by the
pure soul, but they've inhabited the virtual reality suit to operate in a certain environment, and it's got limitations inbuilt.
Right, and you know, we can see that generally. You say if you look at a dog, I mean, they have very nice qualities and very nice features, but we don't see them, you know, building computers, for example.
We don't see them getting themselves into all the mess that we do.
Right.
Maybe they are smarter than we think.
Yes, they could be. They have...
My dog looks at me sometimes and like, why bother? What are you doing all this work for? Look at me, I'm just napping. I know how to live.
Right.
But anyway.
Well, I'm sure if you'd want to trade places, you know, it could be arranged. Sometimes you see movies, you know, based on...
Oh, right, you know, right,
concepts like that. But they're actually the same. They're the same as us, but they're limited by the particular vehicle that they have, just as we are limited by the type of vehicle that we have. Now, what we want to do is get back to all of us, you know, the dogs, the cats, the dolphins, the humans.
Everybody wants to go home again to pure potential.
Get back to their pure, you know, potential. But even in that level of pure consciousness, you know, according to these ancient Sanskrit writings, it's not that everyone is the same. They have a human form of consciousness, a human-like form made of pure consciousness. And some of them, according to their desire, because they want to be in an animal form, or a plant form, or an insect form, but they are in the most glorious, transcendental, ecstatic, you know, kind of animal form or plant form, and their bodies don't die. If their consciousness, for example, is to be a peacock, then they're a peacock forever, and they're the most wonderful sort of peacock, and they have, yeah, that's there.
You mean, once you make a choice, you're locked in forever? Yeah. Don't we get to switch around and try different vehicles?
You can switch around, you can change, but generally, people, yeah, they tend to settle into something that they like.
Oh, I see. But that's after trying many different things, I would
assume.
How do you make that choice? You know, it's like women shopping. Yeah. You got to try in every black cocktail dress in the store before you can make a choice, you know?
And some of us just try to go in as quickly as possible.
That's the guy shopping. Here, give me anything. Does it fit? Yes, I'm out of here. Yeah, I've seen that. Okay, so... this is what the Vedas describe.
Yes, in so many words.
Has it been your mission from the get-go to say, gosh, here I am devoting my life to this ancient wisdom tradition, and I'm looking at what it's saying, and it's a bit different than what my society tells me is the truth, is the history. Therefore, when you went into this, what became an 8-year investigation into human origins and became the basis of the book Forbidden Archaeology. Were you looking at it like, I'm testing my faith, or I'm out here to prove that the standard story isn't the only story that can be, that is the result of the available evidence?
Well, it doesn't have to be either or.
I was just wondering how much you were doubting your own position early on, or how much you were set out to prove. It's a fair question.
Yeah. I would say I had, through other experiences that I had, you know, in terms of meditation and spiritual development, become pretty well convinced that, well, this was something that was really working for me. And
if this is true, then all of it must be true? Or?
It sort of increased my faith about the other things. Now, for many years, I really didn't... for most of the time during my beginning years of my spiritual path, I wasn't so much concerned about what was going on, you know, with the Vedic descriptions about material reality and the history of it and things
like
that.
You had more immediate...
I was more interested in, you know, just cultivating my own, you know, spiritual development rather than thinking about, well, what it had to say about material aspects of reality. I was more
first
focused on
first. Yeah.
The spiritual dimensions that it was, you know, acquainting me with. But then I started looking, and it became... another thing is that everyone has to have some kind of, you know, mission in life. And I have a spiritual teacher, and I saw that he was very interested somehow or other in addition to all the trans-dimensional aspects, you know, of the Vedic teachings, the things that just go beyond time and space. He also seemed to have an interest in, well, what is going on, you know, with this world and how the Vedic teachings relate to it. And he explained, and this is A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, he explained that people's consciousness pretty much is influenced by what they think they are. You know, in other words, if I think I'm an American man, I'm going to
fulfill that.
I'm going to fulfill that. You know, whatever we think we are, we tend to set our goals on that basis. So for quite a number of centuries here in the West, we've been told by, you know, our quote,
we're material beings
that
only.
We're material beings who've evolved from apes and things like that. And I think that's affected our consciousness, and for many people,
and the expression of our potential.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a limiting factor. It's been a roadblock for some people. So I could see, you know, that it might be a useful thing to do with my life to help remove some of those roadblocks that are, as you say, I like the way you put it, the limiting, you know, the potential of you know, people on this planet. And, you know, one way to do that for some people, since material science has become such a source of authority, is to challenge, you know, that, you know, particular mode of thought. And although I was, in the beginning, when I started thinking about this human evolution question and the human antiquity question, I thought, like, well, yeah, on the basis of what I know from, you know, these ancient Sanskrit writings, I was pretty well convinced, you know, that, well, we didn't evolve from the apes and things like that. And when I started my first tentative little bits of research, I thought, like, well, gee, what will I, although I have some inkling, I mean, I really did not expect to find as much evidence as I did. So you could say for me, it was sort of like, you know, a faith-building exercise to start uncovering this evidence, because I really didn't think, you know, that I would find as much as I did. And that was really shocking to me in a deeply personal sense, to find, why haven't I heard about this before?
You know, how are all of these reports buried in these obscure journals?
Yeah, how can I go through 30 years of my life as an intelligent, university-educated person, and, you know, with an inquiring mind even, and not know about this stuff? I mean, why was it buried so deeply? You know, why was it so out of sight?
One thing that was impressive about yours and Richard's research in forbidden archaeology was the thorough investigation, the thorough look that you took at many of these reports, how you found them, how you applied a single set of standards to them to evaluate them, how you said, yeah, this, you know, here's the explanations, how they're explained away, but really these explanations don't hold. They were found in the same strata. They were documented by people who knew what they were doing. They were finding this. So you add it up over and over and over again, and you go, okay, there's a whole missing chapter here.
Yeah.
I don't know what that chapter is, but I know that there's a lot there. And it's fascinating to piece those pieces of the puzzle together as the picture emerges.
Yeah, well, I think the picture that does emerge is that we need a new explanation for, you know, human origins. And you know, in those previous books, Forbidden Archaeology and Hidden History of the Human Race, what we did is simply set forth, you know, the facts that we had uncovered, the reports that we had uncovered, and
let them speak for themselves, and
people can interpret them in different ways. I think we're at a stage where it's really healthy that people just look at this evidence and
let it unhinge them from the standard story.
Right, and some people, they try to explain it by, you know, time travelers, reverse time travelers who got caught back in some very ancient times, and other people try to explain
it. That's just taking the existing paradigm and twisting it to fit.
Yeah, extraterrestrials, you know, visitations and things like that. I mean, I have my own idea, but I don't discourage people from trying to exercise their own intelligence, because I think in the end, they'll come to the right conclusion. But I think at this point, I think we've had a monolithic sort of presentation of,
Actually, what's fascinating to me is that the media may present the scientific consensus as a monolithic whole set in stone. You go behind the scenes and there's so much controversy, and you quote and you found many scientists who disagreed with the interpretation and said this isn't the only way that we can interpret this particular set of data. And their knowledge filtered quietly squelches their voice. We never get to hear it unless it's someone investigating and bring that story to us. I have two questions left in the time remaining. One is, back at the turn of the century, it seemed to be a very exciting time for science because nothing was written in stone yet. There were investigations. People like the Curies could investigate X-rays on the one hand, which were very mysterious at the time, and psychical research on the other hand, and Tesla could do his thing and push the seams of the envelope and physics and all of that. Wasn't there a time, given India's ties to Britain and so many of the, Darwin was a Brit, so much of the controversy and discussion and evolution going on about that time, wasn't there a time when some Vedic scholar would stand up and question to some assembly and go, hey, there's another, Darwin's not the only game in town. Look at what my tradition has to say about evolution and why we are here and how we got here. Evolution and the fact that we might be related to apes was met with dismay to the general public when it was first introduced. We were horrified. Oh, my God, what does that mean? Where does that put us? Look, we're just, apes with a brain, great. So it seems to me there was room for other discussion. Have you found any archives of discussions, of meetings, of presentations? Do you think they exist somewhere? Who knows what's there in the basement of the British Museum or some society?
Well, of course, one thing to keep in mind about Vedic voices was at that time, India was a colony of Britain, and Britain had taken over the education system.
I was wondering about that. So it's like,
so they
move over, we know everything.
Yeah, they had more or less, I mean, the intelligent people who went to the universities got trained up in the European ideas, and this is still something that's, the remnants of that are still there today, although we do have, some of the Indian scholars now waking up and starting to look again at their own tradition, which in their eyes had been devalued. It had been devalued under the centuries that they were under the rule of an outside force. But it's interesting. I've heard this is something that I do want to research, and this is the idea that Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, was familiar with India, and that he had more or less looked at the Indian concept of the transmigration of souls through different species, the idea that conscious cells transmigrate up through the various species until they get to the human form, and then from that form they have the intelligence to get out of the whole cycle of reincarnation. And there's been some suggestion that perhaps this is where the idea of evolution came from.
Oh, how funny.
Now, I'm just saying that because you asked me the specific question, and it's something that I've heard, and it's something I mean to look into. I really want to look into the life of Erasmus Darwin and see if he really was familiar with these Vedic writings about the transmigration of souls through all these different species.
The story of evolution was first expressed by the Vedas long ago in a very different way than Darwin did, but it's the same thing of evolution.
Yeah.
Grow and adapt, and change. How interesting. Last question. There's been a lot of recent discoveries in archaeology of various bones, Lucy and all the other Australopithecus and all the other ones. How close are these two missing links in your opinion? Are they touting it because, they've got to tout something, or is there something there, or are they just misreading it once again in your opinion?
I think they're misreading it. There are many. You were mentioning that even in the scientific community, behind closed doors, there are vast differences of opinion, and there's a significant group of physical anthropologists and archaeologists who think that these Australopithecines and other early so-called missing links are nothing more than just varieties of apes and monkeys, and they say that those on the other side of the divide are just artificially attributing human-like characteristics to these animals that they really don't have. They, for example, they say they attribute to them, the ability to walk on two legs when they really don't have it. When if you look at, the Australopithecus skeleton, you see it was very adapted towards life in the trees and things like that. So I would say that they are touting these things as human ancestors simply because they need to do it. The evidence really doesn't support it that they're human ancestors.
You read these articles and you even see that it's a stretch, and they're talking about the flimsiest evidence, and they're filling in a lot of blanks for you that aren't really there. So you can read between the lines there. I would assume that just as in any animal species, you get a lot of branches that die off, so you can find fossils of something that doesn't exist exactly today in modern times. But they never suggest that about apes. They never say, oh, it's an early ape and an ape that never made it, and oh, it's got to be human. So I keep wondering, what if you think every ape that ever lived in ancient times was on its way to becoming human, or do they recognize apes as apes?
You said it right there. I think they tend to say anything that they find in the period going back to around 3 to 4 million years ago. Somebody's going to say it was on its way to becoming human because they have to. They need that. If they're going to hang on to this evolutionary idea, they need that. But as I've demonstrated, in Forbidden Archaeology and other works, you can find evidence that humans like us were around at that exact same time. 3 million years ago, 4 million years ago, 5 million years ago. So there was definitely coexisting.
That's the point.
Coexisting. It's not that one is related to the other in terms of some evolutionary process, but simply that they were coexisting with each other.
Next time we talk, I want to ask you about how quickly species evolve. And when you look at something like the giraffe, is it possible that you find, great changes within a few 100,000 years? Or are the standard scientists suggesting that somehow on weight from ape to human, we've moved at such an accelerated pace that outpaces any other adaptation? I'm just curious about the time frames to do with other animals. And, I think, just to restate what you're suggesting, that anatomically humans, you can trace back their evidence for their existence on planet Earth back millions of years.
Up to 2 billion years.
Artifacts, bones, tools, footprints, and therefore all of these other apes that you see going on just coexisting. Because why would you need, if the anatomically modern humans are there, why would you need apes coming back into the family tree? What, is it a little detour and then you come back? I don't know. I don't think so. So some really important work that you and Richard Thompson have done. That was Michael Cremo. His books include Hidden History of the Human Race, also Forbidden Archaeology, and In the